Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. If you thought the first year of President Trump's administration was an unprecedented year in politics, just you wait for the year ahead. 2018 brings with it the midterm election, including two big statewide races, with South Florida playing a central role. We've got the race for Florida governor and the race for the U.S. Senate. Two of the most competitive U.S. House races in the nation, meantime, are here in South Florida, and the former head of the Democratic National Committee faces a challenger from the left as she runs for re-election in the months ahead. So are you ready for all the messaging? What about the big money? What are the big issues? Politics 2018. Here we go. A look ahead here on the Florida Roundup with Nancy Ankrum, editorial page editor with our partner, the Miami Herald. Rosemary O'Hara is back with us, the editorial page editor for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And Rick Christie is the editorial page editor for the Palm Beach Post. Now, just a quick note, this is a recorded program, so unfortunately, we can't take your phone calls, but we wish you a happy new year. Rick, let's start with these big statewide races and the role that South Florida plays, not only generating some of the candidates that are running for governor, certainly, the role that South Florida voters are going to be playing in deciding the next U.S. senator, if there is a next one, or the re-election of Senator Nelson, and, of course, the Florida governor. How is this going to play out here?
Well, I think other than fundraising, of course, regarding voters, I think the biggest challenge in South Florida will be for them actually getting out the vote. The votes are here, but if the Democrats, for example, can't motivate people to go to the polls or at least do absentee ballots, South Florida will not, South Florida won't play as big a role as it possibly can play, which it could have done last November, for example. So I think that the role of South Florida in the statewide races, and I'm speaking about the governor's race and the Senate race, is going to be pretty huge in terms of turnout.
Rosemary, primarily. What about that idea that, I mean, turnout always matters in every election, but what we've seen in elections past here in South Florida, is that precedent for what we can see in 2018?
Well, you know, the candidate money matters. Who the candidate is matters. People need to be excited in order to turn out. And I think the politics of our nation has not got people excited. It's got people divided. Maybe anger, anger does motivate people. But what Florida is so important, what's happening in Florida also influences what will happen in 2020 in the presidential election.
You want to go ahead even two more years?
I hope the midterm gives us a reset.
Nancy, to that point, reporters notwithstanding, none of us are asking for sympathy or empathy for that matter from the audience, but aren't Americans just dealing with political exhaustion because of the first year of the Trump administration, regardless of the ideology and if you support it, but just the volatility?
I think there's a weariness. I think there's a weariness unless you are part of the Trump base.
The 20%.
And you are fired up and you are defending your guy. I do think, though, that the majority of us are just so weary. I have to say, we didn't see Monica Lewinsky surface until the second term of the Clinton administration. We didn't see Watergate until,
the Iran-Contra affair was the second term.
Absolutely.
Of Reagan.
Yeah. But we are not a year into this administration, and the investigations and the allegations of corruption and incompetence.
And the tweets.
The tweets are just wearing. I could live with the tweets, but it's what has been done to this democracy in terms of what we are learning about Russian intrusion that is just scary.
But here in South Florida, to Rick's point, and have all of you kind of pipe in on this, is that sowing the seeds of low turnout, of just voter disgust, except for that core base for the president and the core base for the Democrats? Or is this divisiveness, is this dividing nature that we've seen over the past election cycle, is it going to excite the middle?
I think as we get closer to the actual election, it will excite both sides. Again, as Rosemary said, it's going to depend upon the candidates, especially on the Democratic side. We cannot count
in
on
South Florida
in
here,
South
yeah,
Florida,
yeah,
especially we
counties,
cannot
yeah.
count on having a Roy Moore who, as in Alabama, who was just obviously reprehensible, but who only lost by 1%.
That's right.
But, you know,
I'll be honest. Two demographics that I'll be looking for in 2018 is one, the number of voters who have buyer's remorse regarding their vote in November of 2016. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing that a great deal. That mm-hmm. there is a growing, and I even talked to a Republican operative about this a couple of weeks ago. Who used to be a party chairman, who was saying that he admitted that there is a great deal of that going on. And the second demographic I'll be looking at is off of the Alabama race is women, black women
yeah.
in particular,
yeah.
but women and how they will be voting in 2018. I think that's going to be that's a huge demographic that not just the Democrats, the Republicans need to get as well, because they are fired up. They are emotional about what's going to be happening in 2018, in terms of making their voices heard.
The biggest race in Florida is going to be for the U.S. Senate, and it's going to be likely Governor Rick Scott against Bill Nelson. Bill Nelson is not a great campaigner, in my opinion. You know, he ran against Catherine Harris, a weak candidate. Mm-hmm. He ran against Connie Mack, a weak candidate. Now he's going to go up against Rick Scott, who's going to define it.
And Rick Scott, who's got 8 years of performance in the governor's office, who has 8 years of job growth, 8 years of economic growth, 8 years of lower taxes that he has presented as the governor and the legislature generally has approved, and dozens of millions of dollars of personal wealth willing to spend.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's and is using this final year in the governorship to tell the story and, you know, travel the state and jobs, even though so many of those jobs are low-wage jobs, right. which is why we don't have the money in the state budget that they thought. Right. In the meantime, then we got the governor's race. And on the Republican side, there's a brutal battle. I mean, Adam Putnam, Agriculture Commissioner, is kind of laying low while he's raising incredible amount of money. House Speaker Richard Corcoran is, you know, all but declared to mm-hmm. get into this race. And then, of course, we have Senator Jack Latvala, who is on the sidelines now.
Right, accused of sexual harassment.
Right.
And being under investigation by the Florida Senate.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then on the Democratic side, and you know, it's an interesting race. We've got, you know, the daughter of a former governor from North Florida who crosses is a good general election candidate because she managed to win in a Republican area. We've got
Gwen Graham,
right. Then Phil Levine, who's the mayor of mm-hmm. Miami Beach, and you know, he has a story to tell about
mm-hmm. and has personal wealth to spend.
Yes. So it's going to be a big year in for state races and then yes, congressional races.
And we'll talk about congressional races in a second, Nancy, but I'd like your thoughts on this. A year for big money. Rick began this conversation by pointing out the dollars that will be spent. This is going to be, I think it's not going to be any surprise, nor is it any big guess, that this will probably be the most expensive governor's
Absolutely.
Race, and if not the most, one of the most expensive U.S. Senate races.
The stakes are very, very high yeah. here. Money is going to pour in from across the country and no doubt from mm-hmm. abroad to the
yeah.
degree that it can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And people are going to have to take a look at what's all that money buying and why. I think to a large extent, many voters are inured to that element of money in elections.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that they need to consider the degree to which it works. It does work.
Yeah.
It does work.
I think one of the things that people will be looking at, too, is what in the world is John Morgan going to do?
This is the Orlando personal injury attorney.
Who's wealthy in his own right. And as you know, was the proponent who pushed forward medical marijuana, who I believe now has said he's not going to run for the Democratic nomination.
He has said yeah. he's not going to run as a Democrat for governor.
Right,
he has
right.
not ruled out a run for the governor.
Right. Yeah. But I think folks will be wooing him to have his money still be a part of the Democratic candidates rather than him doing something on his own. So I think a lot of people are going to be yeah. watching to see what John Morgan is
Let
doing.
Let me also circle back to this idea, Rick, that you spoke about in terms of a Palm Beach Republican leader talk about buyer's remorse
mm-hmm.
And referring to the 2016 mm-hmm. vote for then-candidate Donald Trump.
Yes.
Is it your sense, and for Rosemary and Nancy, is it your sense too, those Republicans that supported the president here in South Florida, who may be expressing buyer's remorse, is it ideological or is it personal?
That's a good question. I think mostly it's personal, yeah. And the way he's conducting himself in the presidency, and then the other part of it is for them is what has he really accomplished for them.
President Trump.
Yes. Yeah. And I mean, speaking, for example, I remember when I spoke to Trump voters 6 months, I think, afterwards, and one of the big things they brought up was that, you know, he's going to take care of the deficit. And now we get a tax reform bill that's going to add $1.5 trillion at least to the deficit over the next 10 years. So I think that he was speaking more so to the personal, but some policy stuff as well that they're not getting really what they thought, you know. But a lot of it is personal and the way he's been conducting himself in the office.
The way that President Trump won with South Florida Republicans, do you, Rosemary, see that bleeding in to the way Republicans for governor, Republicans for the U.S. Senate, if there are more than one, run and articulate that message in 2018 compared to maybe just even 4 or 6 years ago?
Well, I think it's about the middle class and trying to focus on, you know, the forgotten middle class and a sense that the Democratic Party does not have a clear, cogent message of, you know, what it's about anymore. But in the Republican Party, I think there is a great war going on over what does the party stand for anymore. We used to know what it meant to be a Republican, but then this bill grows the deficit. So I think people support the president and will support the Republican candidate for the Senate or governorship because of a belief that they know what they'll get. They may not like the person, but especially on the Republican side, you know, that they will. It's about the Supreme Court, and it's about, you know, conservative values, whatever that means anymore. So it's ideological more than personal.
Nancy, how do you see maybe that lack of definition in the national parties playing out in the state races and some of the local races here in 2018?
I think that people will go for the devil that they know.
And favor the incumbent.
And that favors the incumbent. I think that the Democrats, they don't have a lot of time to define themselves, either in Florida or nationally. Mm. And I think that the Republicans in this state will recalibrate that anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim message that resonated with the base across the country. This is Florida. You can't quite do that here.
And South Florida especially.
And South Florida especially.
Although we did see, you know, almost 400,000 Trump voters in Dade County alone. I think it was 333,999. I just did some reporting. That's how that number stuck in my head. So, you know, significant number of folks in South Florida, in the blue Dade County, blue Broward, blue Palm Beach, did go for that message.
Absolutely.
Ultimately. And presumably, because it's South Florida, a number of those are foreign born.
Well, they went for Trump in spite of that message, I think. Mm. And it's just very troubling that anti-everything, a racist and a sexist message, an anti-immigrant, a demonization of Muslims and immigrants, that message wasn't enough to trump ideology.
And I think it was 60%, though, still of Miami-Dade that went for Hillary.
That's correct.
Yeah,
so
Hillary won
Hillary won all three of the big counties in South Florida. That
just
is true.
But not big enough margins to give her the state.
Right.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right. It wasn't big enough margins to make up for the support that candidate Trump got in Central and North Florida.
And I think my point was that the Democratic candidate did better in Miami-Dade in that election than historically.
Mm-hmm.
Then
President Obama did,
right,
for instance.
I believe I'm right on that. And then another factor is the arrival of the Puerto Ricans. I mean, right now they're focused on getting their lives together, not registering to vote. But what...
And that's all they need to do is to register to vote. They're citizens.
Right, yes. And they are disappointed with this tax bill that's been passed and with the response, and including the response from the White House. And then the other factor in here are the young people. You know, young people are so disgusted with the division, the political division in our country, that they're signing up as no party affiliates.
Right. And not participating then in the primary process, which is what politics is about between now and August.
Right.
Yeah, in a closed primary state like ours. Yes.
Right.
That's right. And it also speaks, Rick, I think what Rosemary's point is, and the millennial voters, speaks to your other point that you made initially, which was turnout, turnout, turnout.
Right. Yeah, it still is. And I think, though, I just keep seeing on the ground level and on the street more excitement, I guess, you know, by people saying, hey, look, things are not going the way I want them to go. Something needs to be done. You can see this on social media constantly. Now, getting that to translate to people going into the polls and actually voting is another thing altogether, you know, and whether or not that type of excitement will last all the way to next November is also a question. But that's up to the parties. And I think this big independent middle, you know, it's not so much the 30% that's the Democrats, the 30% that are the Republicans. It's that other big middle who can capture the majority of that and actually win. That's what I'll be looking at.
Yeah, not only nationally, but
regionally. Yeah, because as Rosemary, I think, or Nancy said earlier, that 20 to 30% is always going to vote Republican or vote for Donald Trump in the same way on the Democratic side. It's those folks in the middle, and a lot of those young folks, that's where they are. They're in that middle.
Mm-hmm. You know, we will also have to keep an eye on voter suppression efforts.
Mm.
I think that given the outcome in Alabama, I think in this state and in states across the country that are inclined, we're going to see a step up in efforts. I hate to be that cynical.
What
but
kind of
that
form
is
do you think that could take?
Well, you know, Florida already has experience in making sure that, you know, early voting sites were shut down.
Right. We're not open on Sunday.
We're not open on Solstice the Polls Sunday.
Yep.
You know, libraries that suddenly were not early voting sites, mm-hmm. things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We really have to watch that.
One other point I would make is that we're starting to come upon the impact of the Fair Districts Amendments. And which were our best way to create districts that are balanced or make more sense, and rather than being skewed, you know, to the Republican or skewed Democrat, it didn't take effect, or its impact wasn't felt immediately because there were still incumbents in those districts and incumbency wins. But as incumbents, especially in the state level, come up on term limits, and people are running in these districts, I think that redistricting had an impact on why Annette Tadeo won over Pepe Diaz in that district.
The special election in Senate District 40.
Right. And I think there's another Senate district to the west of that it could have an effect.
Hmm.
So, you know, let us hope that that fair districts, which creates a, you know, more balanced playing field, will finally see the payoff.
Hmm. Let's move from state districts to congressional districts. Two of the most competitive races, probably the most expensive races, are going to be here in South Florida in Dade County, the 27th significant. There is no incumbent here, Nancy.
Right.
Ileana Ross Leighton, who had been in that seat since 1989, decided to retire, no longer running for reelection. She has, as a Republican, she has not been a Trump supporter on any number of different issues, immigration, Cuba, Cuba not necessarily, but immigration,
right.
Taxes, healthcare, others. This is a wide open race.
It's a wide open race. You know, she showed that same independence during the Bush administration,
mm-hmm.
and I give her a lot of credit for that. I have just been rubbing my hands together in glee, really looking at what a wide open race of this import has brought forth. And, you know, I have in the past talked about the lack of a bench among the Democrats, but it really has brought forth a very interesting and significant bunch of Democrats.
Very crowded field, however.
A very crowded field.
10, I think, at the last count.
10, and I think that by the time Election Day rolls around, or qualifying rolls around, we're going to see even fewer than that.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have seen some heavyweights. We have seen some surprises. We've seen experienced candidates who have been serving in the legislature. I think it's going to be just a fascinating race to watch.
It's an interesting district here. It stretches some of the more wealthy parts of Dade County and then goes out west to areas around Miami International Airport. It's also one of the top three congressional districts where residents are enrollees in the Affordable Care Act. I believe it's right around 100,000 or so, maybe perhaps a little bit more, a little bit less, but it's among the top three. And also in that list is the 26th Congressional District, which is South Dade County and the Keys and Monroe, currently held by Republican Carlos Curbelo, who is now a two-term congressman in this seat that tended to move almost every 2 years between a Democrat and a Republican.
He has a moderate sensibilities. We have seen him come forward on climate change and putting together a group that will not argue about the causes but wants to deal with what we are seeing on the ground, which is a lot of water.
Yeah.
But he also, you know, supported the repeal of ACA. Mm-hmm. He will likely vote for this tax bill. Yeah. So he will have a lot to answer for, and I consider his seat in play.
You're in play. And on the Ross Layton seat, is that in play between the parties? I mean, there's 10 Democrats. I think there's only three Republicans right now.
Mm-hmm,
and that's a seat that Ross Layton has held as a Republican for a good long time, but consistently has been seen as a purple district.
Right. Absolutely. I think that seat is definitely in play. And I do think that there is a strong field of Democrats running right now. They've got to make the case.
Meantime, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, congresswoman in Broward County, down to kind of across 595 and then down to Miami Beach, kind of this L-shaped district, Rosemary, former chair of the Democratic National Commission, committee, rather, under a lot of fire for her leadership then and there, a lot of criticism, survived a challenge in 2016 from the left by Tim Canova. He's already declared that he is running again. What's at stake for this district?
Well, what's at stake? It doesn't have any chance of flipping in terms of from Democrat to Republican.
The real race is in the primary here.
Absolutely. I would say that Debbie is beaten up, that she, her leadership of the DNC has not gotten glowing reviews. She doesn't seem to be that popular with a lot of people, even though she helped raise a lot of money for people. And in some ways, she's still got connections in the community. She's brought home the bacon. I don't know that she's popular. I think she's edgy, and just in terms of the newspaper, mm-hmm. she's kind of gone dark. And for the editorial, I've had trouble reaching her on several issues. That said, Tim Canova, smart guy who has a lot of energy, but he's kind of a poke in the eye kind of guy.
Mm.
You know, he's more criticizing her than talking about why he's different. And I think that he got his propulsion from Bernie Sanders,
right,
and that he was unable to make it across the finish line with Bernie Sanders' team behind, or his supporters behind him, makes the odds of him making it across the finish line this time less.
But you know, to your point earlier about this this buyer's remorse on the part of Trump supporters, could that same kind of feeling be in effect with the Wasserman Schultz supporters? Not buyer's remorse for Congressman Wasserman Schultz, but instead the inability of the more progressive side of her district to get Canova into that general election solidify the base for him. How vulnerable is she from a run to the left?
We're an older market, her and it's not I don't think she's very vulnerable.
I would agree. I don't think she's very vulnerable. And I don't think that her troubles at the national level with the DNC, if she's bringing home the bacon, it's not going to filter down.
We didn't see that. If it was going to filter down, it would have been 2016 would have been the year that the local residents would have... It would have resonated with them, right, Rick?
I agree with that, too. I don't see her as being that vulnerable. Yeah, she's taking kind of a pounding, you know, and everything in the national press. But when it comes down to it, if you're my local congressman and you're bringing home what you're supposed to be bringing home, you're going to be returned to office. I think, to your point about the buyer's remorse comment from me, I think that where that may play out, or where more so will be with Congressman Brian Mass
over the 19th district,
Northern Palm Beach County and Southern Martin County,
Republican,
yes, and hometown Stewart, by the way, just want to throw that out there, and I think because he has been lockstep with the president on pretty much everything,
very vocal, you know, in that as well,
and there's been a lot of the voters in that area become more and more vocal about they're disenchanted with him because even though they are a bit conservative, you know, in that part, in those parts, they're still very moderate, you know, environmentalists and so on and so forth. And they're not extreme, and he has come across that way in walking in lockstep with the president. So the question now is, who would the Dems put up against him, you know? And I'm kind of, you know, and I'm just throwing this out of left field. I'm kind of waiting to hear what Patrick Murphy has to say, the former congressman of that district,
who decided
his ill-fated run against Marco Rubio.
Is there a base for him to reignite there still, two years later?
Yeah, he's still known there. He's kept his face out in front of the crowd and everything. And I forgot what exactly he's working on some policy thing. So he's kept his face out there. But he was very well known, very well liked. Mm-hmm. If he wanted to stay, he could have stayed. You know, in that seat, it was a safe seat for the Democrats, to be honest with you. So it'll be interesting to see what they decide to do.
With the Curbelo Republican seat in play, Nancy, with the Republican Ross Leighton seat in play, Mast perhaps being in play, does this change the makeup of the Florida delegation into Washington, South Florida especially, into 2018? And as Ross Leighton leaves, you do lose quite a bit of seniority that South Florida had been able to enjoy in Congress's past, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Is it a major shift? It would be an encouraging shift for Democrats. I'm not quite sure, though, in voting power, especially in the House, if it's going to make a big, big difference. It's going to be this, you know, poco a poco kind of approach that the Democrats have to take.
And I think the Dems and Republicans in South Florida tend to work pretty well together in Congress on issues for the region as well.
Yeah, we've seen that on climate issues. Yeah, right. Arguably, some would like to see more of it on transportation issues, which we'll talk about.
Yeah, on bigger national issues, may find some division, but on regional issues, they seem to work really well together.
Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post is along with us. Nancy Ankrum with the Miami Herald and Rosemary O'Hara with the Sun Sentinel. It is our op-ed board here. 2018, the year ahead on the Florida Roundup, still to come. The year and the battle over immigration to come. Dreamers, temporary protection status recipients, and South Florida. That's next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. It's 2018, the year in preview today on WLRN. Thanks so much for listening. La Grande June is 7 years old. She was born in the United States. Her mom was born in Haiti. She's here in South Florida under the temporary protected status.
I feel confused.
If you had a mother and just a daughter, and the mother got deported from the child, what would happen to the child?
Yelink June is among the thousands of Haitians in South Florida who could be spending 2018 preparing to be forced to return to their native home. The temporary protected status for Haitians is due to expire in July 2019.
I don't even speak to the whole family yet to have something set up for us, but it's something that's coming. I don't really make any plans right now.
Other immigrants who have been in South Florida under TPS face closer deadlines. TPS for El Salvador expires in March this year. For Hondurans, it's in July. For Nicaraguans, it's January of 2019. Now, in the meantime, Dreamers, undocumented kids who were brought here to the U.S., face their own deadline to end the program known as the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA. The program has allowed 800,000 people who came to the U.S. without authorization to stay and study and work legally. Gabby Pacheco came to the U.S. from Ecuador when she was 8 and was a DACA recipient until she got married.
You cannot say that Dreamers are not Americans, especially when we're speaking the language, living among the community, have grown up here, and are just like anyone else with a dream and desire to give back.
Saul Zalaman's parents brought him here from Mexico when he was 3. He's 25 now, living in Homestead and studying for his bachelor's degree in accounting at Florida International University.
We're going to have to build meaningful relationships with the community in order for us to have each other's backs. I definitely do think that there will be a shift in lifestyle if there isn't a solution for the situation. We'd go back to like not being able to drive, not being able to work, not being able to commute to where we want to go.
Immigration certainly is a national issue, but we know it as a local story here in South Florida. How could decisions on immigration in the new year impact this community, impact this economy, impact your family, your friends? Nancy Ankrum, editorial page editor for the Miami Herald, is still with us. Rick Christie does the same at the Palm Beach Post. Rosemary O'Hara holds down that position at the Sun Sentinel. This is a recorded program, so unfortunately we can't take your phone calls, but thanks for listening. Nancy, let's begin with TPS, temporary protection status, that is due to expire for Haitians, which is the largest group of South Floridians impacted, in 2019. There have been heavy lobbying on the part of the Haitian community, in South Florida for that matter, to try to get the Trump administration to continue the temporary protection status beyond this expiration, but the efforts failed so far.
So far, they do have some time, and they need to, Haitians who are affected, Haitians who are not affected, and other immigrants really need to reach out to the business community especially. The business community doesn't know what it's going to do. So many of the people who have TPS here have gone on, have gotten degrees that have allowed them to be medical technicians, medical personnel, working in hospitality, and they are clear that they are going to lose a large segment of their workforce. They need to come to the fore and talk to the Trump administration, you know, business people to businessmen.
Rosemary, the supporters of the Trump administration's movement on this temporary protection status expiration, not only for Haitians, but for El Salvadorans, for Hondurans, and for Nicaraguans, will say it's embedded in the title of the program, temporary. And for the Haitian TPS, this has been in place since 2010. For some of the countries in Central America, it's been in place even much longer because of Hurricane Mitch from many, many, many years ago. And the president is putting the temporary back in TPS.
That's right. It is meant to be a temporary status, 18 months, because the conditions back in your country are so volatile, either because of hurricanes or environmental or even political. So it was meant to be temporary, and they have gotten extended 18 months at a time, mm-hmm. over and over. In the case of Haiti, it's hard to say that the conditions have improved. Does anybody believe that they've improved there? So to now, you know, require that 50,000 people go back to a country that's not equipped to take them and to, you know, leave children here, doesn't make sense. In some of the other cases, if it's been 20 years, El Salvador, you know, I don't know. I'm not as familiar with the conditions there. But both this and the DACA show the failure of our federal government to deal with the issue of immigration. And while it's easy for me or us here to talk about issues and policy, that little clip at the beginning, mm-hmm. it all comes back to real people, yeah. and families that this is their lives, and they get, we lose sight of them.
LaGrande June, the 7-year-old who was born in the U.S., her mom came from Haiti after the earthquake and has been here under TPS, Rick, and asked what would happen to the child. She doesn't know, speaking in the third person, but clearly probably likely referring to herself. But Rick Christie, what about that, what Rosemary is referring to, kind of this patchwork of immigration policies, yeah, here TPS because of the earthquake in Haiti or Hurricane Mitch in Central America. Here it's deferred action for childhood mm-hmm. arrivals. Here it's deferred action for family arrivals. All of these kinds of stopgap measures.
Right. I think it's just, it just shows how much immigration has become one of those third rails in politics that they talk about it a lot. They talk about how important it is, and they never actually do anything. And I think regarding, and again, you just pointed to one of the big factors in terms of of TPS is children,
right,
who are affected by this. Yeah. Our chief operating officer in Palm Beach County Schools has written an op-ed about that very fact, about the number of children in public schools who are embedded in our public schools, who they are taking care of, you know, and everything. What's going to happen to these children that they are responsible for educating?
Not only children who arrived and have TPS, but children
but who were born,
like
LaGrande, here,
who were born here.
Yes,
you know,
right,
in the,
yes,
in the
exactly,
Haitian case, yeah, these are kindergartners, first and second graders.
Absolutely,
now
they know no other country. Right. This is their country, and that's why I think.
And legally, it's their country.
Yeah,
we should
actually
point out.
A good point, yeah, and that we're at the point now where yes, TPS is temporary protected status. However, if you've been here in some cases for more than a decade, going on 20 years, there needs to be, clearly Congress needs to be, or even the Trump administration really needs to show some bravery and create a path to citizenship for these people.
And there are members of the South Florida congressional delegation, Nancy, who have tried to lead that debate to try to put forth a path to some kind of permanent residency, right, for TPS as well as for DACA at that,
right,
at
exactly,
that point. Yeah.
And when you're looking at TPS, whether it's Haitians or the Nicaraguans or others from South America, the numbers are not that large.
Right, that's right.
And indeed, these are people who are embedded in this community. This is an administration that does not proceed with nuance in trying to keep the promise of tackling undocumented immigrants. And so let's take TPS and DACA out of it. We still see raids that are separating families. Mm-hmm. We see raids that have sent a few legalized mm-hmm. citizens mm-hmm. back to their home country. And it is another enforcement too, not just the law, but enforcement too is this sorry patchwork that is charging forth with no thought, with little guidance, and with no common sense.
The enforcement in 2017 locally brought up a lot of debate in Dade County, Broward and Palm Beach County, all the counties, about this idea of a sanctuary city. Miami-Dade in January of 2017, I think it was, Mayor Carlos Jimenez essentially said that we're not a sanctuary city in South Florida, in Miami-Dade, under the threat of some federal funding that wound up coming through, and the county commission did pass a new statement that said it was not a sanctuary,
right,
for the kind of undocumented immigrants.
Exactly. What we did find out, however, is that I think Chicago is a sanctuary city, and it got those federal funds.
Right, right. Oh, so there didn't seem to be the judgment at the end that those, right, funds were tied. But to Rick and to Rosemary, we've seen other communities expressly state undocumented immigrants are welcome here. We're not, yeah, going to be working hand in glove with immigration authorities. That's a federal law enforcement. We don't do federal law enforcement.
Yeah, there's been a couple of cities in Palm Beach County, West Palm Beach, Lake Worth. However, we just had a recent uproar in Boynton Beach where a commissioner who is Haitian-born brought it up for discussion, whether or not the city should become a sanctuary city, which is just a designation,
right,
which is
the Justice Department says there,
yeah,
is no,
there is
legal
no
designation,
yeah,
of a,
yeah,
sanctuary,
I mean,
city.
But the amount of vitriol that she had to face just by bringing that topic up and to discuss it really caught a lot of people, most people, by surprise. And which goes to just how, with two things. One, how much people really don't understand the policy overall and what it is. And I guess the amount of racial animus there is in some of our communities regarding this.
It's just below the surface.
Yes. Yeah. And that this really needs to be discussed, or that the immigrant issues need to be discussed, not just on a national level.
Yeah.
In terms of our Congress and our administration, but even in our local communities, particularly in counties like Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach County, which have large Haitian immigrant communities.
Large foreign-born populations, Rosemary.
Right. You know, our country was built on immigrants, and yet there are, for a lot of people here, a sense that we need to close the door behind us. And a sense that, yeah, you know, there are a lot of criminals coming here, and that's why we need that wall. And most of the country just isn't where we are. I'll bet there's no other New Year's program that's talking about TPS and DACA today.
Probably not a local program like
exactly.
this is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, these are not key issues in Montana and Wyoming and Utah and all those other states where Representative Ileana Ross-Layton said, you know, I can't get anybody excited about this. I can't get people in Congress to talk about DACA or TPS because it's a loser. It's not an issue that affects a whole lot of people. We know it affects our region, families, our economy, our businesses, our morals, you know, about separating families. But
you make the economic argument. I mean, here in South Florida, where a good percentage of the workforce are foreign-born, no doubt about it, economic research after economic research has looked at the low wage issue when it comes to immigration. Is immigration causing low wages, or did low wage draw in immigrants? And it has been shown that it is the low wage that has drawn in immigrants. As Americans, native-born Americans, American citizens have been steered away from those kinds of jobs. Either they didn't want to do the hard work or it just wasn't worth it. The jobs still exist in the poultry plants, in the tomato fields, in the strawberry fields, in the chambermaids. Those jobs still exist, and immigrants have filled those roles.
And too many people are still buying the falsehood that illegal immigration has displaced us. No, you know, globalization has displaced those jobs. Mm-hmm. And it always amazes me how specifically the Republican Party has gotten people to vote against their own interests. The jobs that they have lost across the Rust Belt have been offshored. And robotics, mm-hmm. not illegal immigrants, are really the next wave of job and career replacers.
So where do we look for immigrants and immigration as a policy and intersecting politics locally, statewide, and nationally in 2018? TPS has those deadlines. DACA has the deadlines. This is going to remain in the headlines in a significant way.
It'll be in the headlines, but there's nothing that's going to happen because it's an election year, and there's just no, you know, upside for politicians to bring up immigration, let alone a solution to immigration, unless it's the wall. So I don't see any action happening.
I think it's every group for itself. I do think DACA will be pulled out of the fire in some form. There's a lot of action going on off radar to somehow ameliorate their problem.
Address some of that pathway to residency or citizenship,
right.
Ultimately.
Right.
Yeah.
And President Trump suggested that if Congress didn't do something, that he might change his mind yet again.
Right, and go the executive route way, which would likely wind up in court, as we experienced in the first few weeks of the Trump administration in January. All right. Rosemary O'Hara with the Sun Sentinel, Nancy Ankrum with the Miami Herald, and Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post are going to stick with us here. 2018, will it be the year of the return of downtown passenger rail service? And will it untangle traffic in South Florida? That's next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Last spring, it was expected to start rolling in July. By October, the launch was delayed until before the end of 2017. With the new year, passenger rail service between the downtowns of Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and West Palm Beach is on the calendar. Brightline. It has years of pledges of bringing express train service back to the major downtowns of South Florida. It promises to bring 32 trains a day when it's running at full service. It has already brought three new train stations to the three downtowns, acting as magnets for real estate development interest.
The location of the stations so make them unique because they are right in the city centers of each of these three cities in Southeast Florida.
That's Brightline CEO Dave Howard. The trip between Miami to Fort Lauderdale expected to take about a half an hour and then another 30 minutes to West Palm Beach. So who's the target customer?
It is going to be someone who will want to take advantage of what we offer in terms of speed and convenience and productivity.
Rick Christie, editorial page editor at the Palm Beach Post. Rosemary O'Hara with the Sun Sentinel. Nancy Ankrum with the Miami Herald. All three of you represent the stations, essentially, of the Bright Line. So let's begin up north, Rick. How about it? Will this untangle traffic?
I think it will help untangle traffic, but I think the biggest thing that they're looking for is attracting more, Mr. Howard was saying, attracting more people to the downtown, particularly catering to younger folks, millennials, yeah, who don't want to buy cars.
So
or don't
it's
own
a
cars.
Real estate play with a railroad,
yeah,
part.
More so up in our neck of the woods, yeah. Yeah. Not that traffic is great, yeah, in Palm Beach County, you know, by any means, but I think right now it's more of a real estate play.
How about it, Rosemary?
Oh, I'm excited about it. I can't wait to ride the train from Fort Lauderdale to Miami.
And you can come to our studios on the train.
Hey, there you go, and Uber it over here. It's disappointing that it's late. It's been delayed. They, yeah, don't reveal very much information about what it's going to cost or.
In terms of the fare, the ticket cost.
They got good news that they've been approved to go to Orlando,
right,
and when that takes place. For those in the cities of Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm, and Orlando, this is a good thing. Mm-hmm. The people in the cities in between, yeah, not so much. In terms of traffic, it is going to interrupt traffic on east-west major roads, no question.
Yeah, as the train crosses those roads 32 times a day.
Exactly.
Yeah, as,
yeah,
well as the new river in Fort Lauderdale.
That's
a lot,
right,
of consternation
and with the
that.
Cargo trains, with the, yeah, CSR Tri-Rail.
Yeah, are we putting too much promise into this, though, as trying to answer some of the tangled traffic
Look,
loads?
There is no magic wand that's going to unsnarl, right, traffic in South Florida, but this goes a great ways toward helping. And again, it's, as I said about another issue, it's going to be a poco-a-poco approach here. But
but this is an express train, Nancy. Right. It's supposed to go.
We'll see.
Yeah.
One of the beauties of Brightline is that it gets rid of, or at least lessens, that last mile problem, mm-hmm, that we see with Tri-Rail, mm-hmm, and other forms of transportation, yeah, where it will at least let you, the last mile problem is Tri-Rail lets you off, but you still have to get downtown and,
yeah,
how do you do that?
Yeah.
Uber, the bus, the cab, whatever. And this connects directly with Metro Rail here in Miami-Dade County. And so that is a big, and I just think it is a great, it is a great look toward the future, because, mm-hmm, I think as Rosemary, or maybe as Rick said, we will be seeing an increasing demographic of young people who, mm-hmm, don't want to own a car,
yeah, yeah,
who have moved here from cities where transportation actually works.
Yeah, it's about mobility, not just transportation,
right,
mobility.
Absolutely.
Nancy Ankrum with the Miami Herald, Rosemary O'Hara with the Sun Sentinel, and Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post. All three of you, Happy New Year, and thanks for spending your time with us on
Happy
the Roundup.
Happy New Year, Tom.
Finally on the Roundup here, 2018 may be the year Florida springs forward permanently or falls back and stays back. Two competing bills in the state legislature hope to change the twice-a-year clock changing around daylight saving time when we spring forward an hour in March. One bill, called the Sunshine Protection Act, wants to observe daylight saving time throughout the year, but a separate bill aims to exempt Florida from the practice and keep Florida on standard time all the time. It should be noted that neither proposal provides penalties for anybody running on beach time. So there you go. All right, that'll do it for the Florida Roundup. Happy New Year. It's produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our technical supervisor is Jason Zapka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for supporting WLRN, and have a great and wonderful New Year.